I just started the recording, and a welcome to LA Jews for Peace special Zoom session on Monday, June 6th with Thea Dalesha, who will be briefing us on the recent an event that happened in Israel-Palestine that should be of interest to all Americans, because an American, Shireen Abu Akla, was assassinated by the IDF. And she was a journalist, and she wasn't the first journalist to be assassinated. We'll hear all about that in a minute or two. First, I want to, I want to remind people of what's coming up. In 2 weeks at this time, on Monday, June 6th, we have our Mazard Boroujdi, who will be talking about the Iran nuclear deal. And the Iran nuclear deal is very high in the media again. For a while, it looked like Russia was going to undercut it, but for reasons I don't understand, and maybe we'll learn then, Russia seems to be now backing it. A month after that, on Monday, July 18th at 7 o'clock, we have Elisheva Goldberg, who works for New Israel Fund. And she's written about the house demolitions, namely the Masafer Yatta house demolitions, which will be, if they go forward, will be expulsion of thousands of Palestinians. And there are at least three congressional letters I know of opposing or asking the US government to fight those demolitions. So what we're gonna do is we're going to look one more second at the opening screen, and I'm gonna stop the sharing, and I'm gonna turn the microphone over to Dick Platkin, who will introduce our speaker.
Hello, everybody. Our guest speaker tonight is Thayer Dalesha. I happen to know him very well because he's my son-in-law, but that's not the reason he's the speaker tonight. He, as we know from many conversations, he follows the Israeli press in both Hebrew and in Arabic, and he knows what's going on in the United States as well, so it gives him a unique perspective. And he's very familiar with this assassination. And just as a little personal biography, he grew up in a town near Nazareth of about 10,000 people. So he can talk later, if you want, in the Q&A about his experiences of growing up in a segregated Palestinian village. This is a village of the people who call themselves 48ers, so he can also explain who a 48er is. And he, after high school, he attended the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, where he studied English, linguistics, and communications. And then later he moved to Tel Aviv, where he got a second degree in film, and he now works in the film industry in Los Angeles. And some of you can see on my screen, to my right is my daughter, Leah, who's his wife. Thayer knows a lot of the details about this assassination. So I'm gonna turn it over to him if he wants to add anything more in self-introduction, or if you wanna jump right into it, go right ahead.
Hello, everyone.
Oh, one more thing, everybody should mute themselves. And if you know people who are not able to log on now, but would like to watch a copy afterwards, we are taping this one. And I see that there's already something in the chat. Okay.
Hello, everyone. Thank you, Dick, and thank you, Jeff. Thank you for the introduction and for this event. I want to start with one thing that is a little bit personal information about how I dealt with the murder or the assassination of Shireen Abu Akleh as a Palestinian. I woke up in the middle of the night because a few days prior to that, there was the planning of, I'll give some pretext for the whole week. A year prior to what happened during the beginning of May, there was the events that happened in last May in 2021, where basically settlers accompanied by Israeli forces, police and military raided the mixed cities in Israel, that Palestinian 48ers like myself also live in there. I mean, when I say mixed cities, they have both ethnicities, like both Palestinians and Israelis, but they're not really mixed because it's a system of segregation in those cities. But the bottom line is that it was commemorating those events where there were pogroms in, happening in the streets. A lot of settlers came, for example, to the city of Lod or Lod, to the city of Haifa and to the city of Yaffa, and basically attacked Palestinians and Palestinian-owned homes and businesses, accompanied and actively assisted by the police and Israeli forces. A year later, which is this year during May, and specifically May 11, or the week of May 11th, I was following the news very closely. And there was like warnings of bad things are going to happen. And I had really a lot of trouble sleeping at night. And the night I woke up, the night of the 11th, I woke up in the middle of the night with like a really bad gut feeling. And I had to, you know, open my phone and to see the news, what is happening. And the first thing I saw that Shireen Abu Akleh was killed. Without knowing any further information, my heart sunk. I honestly felt like I lost a family member. And every Palestinian, and not just Palestinians, Arab around the world have this idealized perspective about Shireen Abu Akleh. She was truly a force of nature, a person who lived for the cause and truly died for the cause, died trying to cover what was happening in Palestine and what the Palestinians were enduring for her 25-year coverage at Al Jazeera Arabic. I felt devastated and I had 2 days of mourning. Like I couldn't really think or do or even like do whatever that can distract me from the fact that we lost an icon, we lost a person that showed our struggle in the most authentic way. And we believe, not only myself, but almost every Palestinian I know, and probably most Palestinians in the world, feel that this was deliberate. This was an act to enforce a collective trauma. And it was planned, that it wasn't like, oh, we have her right now in a scope all of a sudden, and let's shoot at her and see what happens. We believe that it goes further than that, that she was actually lured in and assassinated. And there are a lot of debate happening on social media. It's I couldn't find outside of social media like articles about it right now, but a lot of resources and her last message that she sent in her social media, saying that she was on her way to Jenin to cover up what is happening there, which is an IOF, or if you will, IDF invasion, invasion of the Jenin refugee camp. We call it IOF because we don't see it like the Israeli occupation forces, because for us, it doesn't really defend the state of Israel. It actually occupies the West Bank territories in Gaza, although Gaza is more, you know, an open air prison, but it's still under occupation. Going back to Shireen Abu Akleh, so basically what happened to Shireen was that she was covering possible clashes that happened between Israeli soldiers and resistance forces, Palestinians in the Jenin refugee camp. And there was a few sources. One of them was a video that shows her wearing like the full gear of the press, wearing like the blue protection vest, bulletproof vest with the words press in the front and in the back, and wearing the helmet, accompanied by other journalists. And she was marching towards the Israeli I call it, I don't want to call it an outpost. It was a military vehicle that soldiers were inside of it. So she was basically walking slowly towards the military military car, and out of nowhere, like, you don't hear any kind of bullets hailing from both sides. You hear nothing other than people who were looking at the scene and seeing that there's, oh, a very famous journalist right now, sort of a VIP, if you will, covering an event. And that's usually attracts a lot of people who, luckily, they were holding cameras and filming the whole thing. A few minutes in, you see that there was gunshots aimed obviously towards Shireen Abu Aqli and her colleagues who were also at the scene. And you see in the video, which I can share maybe later on, but in the video you see that, like, she falls down dead basically from the first bullet that hits her in the head. It's basically behind the ear and like between the ear and the, oh sorry, behind, like in front of the ear, in her sort of this area right here, with a high caliber round that is used by Israeli military snipers. And that was confirmed, by the way, with the Palestinian investigation that clearly showed that she was targeted and shot deliberately. And after that, after the shot, another journalist, I think he was, I forgot his name, but he was the producer of Al Jazeera working with her. He was shot in the back. And then the video is like heart-wrenching a little bit, a lot actually, not a little bit. You see that some journalist called Shada Hanaishi, she's like the main witness basically, who was there hiding behind a tree, looking down at her dead body, at Shireen Abu Aqli's dead body, and trying to, you know, drag her from the bullets. And you hear and you see more bullets hailing towards them and hitting the trees and hitting around them. So not only that she was assassinated, but she was also prevented from any kind of possibility to be helped. Those bullets were targeted to at the people who tried to drag her from the scene and maybe like to give her some medical assistance. There was another, excuse me, sorry, dropped it. There was another journalist named Mujahid Saadi, who was heard in the video screaming at somebody to help her, like somebody to drag her. And another person then jumped, who's like, I didn't get to identify him. He wasn't really, like nothing was published about him, but you see him jumping over like a wall and drags her from the scene after a few minutes. And then like she was basically dead on impact. From testimonies of her other Al Jazeera people who went to, you know, to her funeral, and they actually got to say goodbye to her. They describe the head that was, the skull was completely shattered. Like, it's like, I'm sorry for the description, but it was mushy. That shows that like the impact wasn't something that like a bullet ricocheted or something like that. It was a direct impact by a bullet that was identified right now only by the Palestinian authorities, which they refuse to collaborate with any Israeli investigations. And for a very good reason, honestly, because if you look at the track record of Israeli investigations, you would understand how much of a joke it is, because they have less than 1% conviction rate, something around like maybe 0.5%, 99% clearance rate when it comes to handling these kind of complaint about misconducts and direct assault on civilians and journalists. On the other hand, when it comes to Palestinians doing any kind of act of retaliation against Israel, usually it's 99% conviction rate. So that shows that like there is little to no trust between the Palestinian authorities and Israel. And what is more interesting about it is the way it was covered in the media around the world, like talking about Western media versus Israeli media versus Palestinian and Arabic medias. In my search to find whatever information available, the first few days, it was described and depicted as a death of a Palestinian, just a death. Like that's the most that you would get out of media outlets like BBC or even like CNN later on corrected and they did an investigation. But early on, it shows the deep-rooted propaganda, Israeli propaganda that actually either controls or influences in some way or another those kind of media outlets that you couldn't really have any kind of conviction, any kind of condemnation over this horrific act. And it was basically siding and covering up Israeli crimes. What I found from Arab news outlets was the complete shock, obviously. They described it as an act, like a deliberate act of assassination. From the beginning, it was clear to them and to people who knew what Al Jazeera represents that it was a direct assault, not just somebody died in a crossfire or in a like from the Palestinian side of the shooting, because there was no Palestinian side present in the scene or anywhere around it. The first day also in Israel, they immediately denied any involvement of Israelis in this act, and they accused actually Palestinians without any proof, without anything to rely on other than Hasbara Act, which Hasbara means explanation in the actual definition of the word, but they use as like as a means to undermine the Palestinian narrative, it's usually not really reliant on any kind of acts of truth, but a way to manipulate the information towards believing in the Israeli narrative. The Israeli narrative changed in the next 3 days that followed the assassination. They changed at least four times, because they started first accusing the Palestinians. Then when the Palestinian says that they have a bullet, before even investigating the bullet, the thing said the narrative changed to there might be a possibility of a crossfire that happened, and she might have been hit by an Israeli soldier. Then they say that they might have the weapon and the person that actually shot her. And towards the end, they said then they requested a joint investigation with the Palestinians. And lastly, they actually said that we would not investigate it because we don't see any kind of act of crime that was committed. And they completely dismissed the Palestinian narrative and the eyewitnesses, and even the CNN report later on that showed a detailed investigation into what happened using forensic evidence from sound engineers, for example, who analyzed the sound coming from the rifle and determined the actual distance from, like the approximate distance that the bullet was shot from, the eyewitnesses, that all of them clearly saw a deliberate act, and the act didn't stop by just one bullet and assassination, but continued in shooting other people who were present there, clearly marked as press. And and then they shot to prevent them from providing any kind of medical help. What I wanted also to mention is that this is not the first. Shireen's case is a little bit different because she was very famous and known and respected and loved by millions of people. I remember growing up in like during the second Intifada, she was the voice that was, although we were younger and weren't really interested in the news, but her voice shaped us. I remember my younger sister standing in front of us and saying, Shireen Abu Aqli, Al Jazeera, Jenin. And she was, I think, 7 years old, the most. That's something that really impacted all of us again. But the thing is, it's not the first and it wouldn't be the last, because last week, another journalist was killed by Israeli forces. It's not even, I tried to look on any English speaking magazines or news outlets or journals, and I couldn't find anything about her. She was less known. I think she was starting a new job. The same day she started a new job, she was killed by an Israeli round to her chest. I did try to figure out numbers, like to see how many Palestinian journalists were killed in Israel-Palestine by Israeli forces. I found multiple things. One of them, it's the UNESCO Observation Center. And it says that there were, since the year 2002, there were 19 Palestinian journalists killed. And that doesn't include, so it's actually 20, because there is no record of the latest one that got killed near Qalandia checkpoint. It's a real tragedy that it is almost impossible to have a clear indication worldwide a clear condemnation worldwide into such a mundane thing to be condemning, which is a murder of a Palestinian journalist, a Palestinian American to be exact, because the fact that she's American doesn't really hold anywhere, because she has also the title of being Palestinian, and it shows clearly that Palestinians don't really matter to the world. It's completely like swept under the rug usually, or manipulated into just a regular person dying on the job and not describe it what it actually is. I think I summed up mostly what I believe that happened with Shireen. What I would like to further expand upon is the fact that Palestinians are still mourning. They're probably never gonna forget what happened to Shireen Abu Aqli. And it shows us a lesson that we are on our own, and we need to be a little bit more resilient than what we were until today, with how we deal with grief, how we deal with the lack of interest from the rest of the world. And hopefully things will change because of what has happened specifically to Shireen. We believe that her message was so powerful that even after her death, she's gonna make an impact. I truly believe that this is not gonna be another case that people are gonna forget about soon after, that this is gonna be something that will be prosecuted. We have little faith in the international law, honestly, but it's gonna be something, a catalyst into a certain type of change in our awareness and in the way Palestinians everywhere see the international media. And luckily for us these days, people are exposed to other non-mainstream medias, like in social media, for example, groups on WhatsApp and Telegram and those kind of things make it that this kind of monopolies over information are actually, I believe they're dying. They're not gonna hold for much longer. It's a relic from the past. And information these days is much more diverse and less controlled than it used to be. And yeah.
We'll move into our question period. So I see that Tony has his hand up, and if you know how to raise your hand, you can do it. If not, you'll just put your hand up like that, and we'll call on you. So Tony,
Fire, what is the reaction? What has been the reaction of the Palestinian Authority?
What I believe and what I read, of course, is that they refuse any kind of cooperation with Israeli authorities. They clearly stated that they have zero faith in the Israeli system of prosecution. And they believe that the request for the bullet, which is the main evidence, is just to cover up and make the Palestinian side not credible.
Yeah. Has Abu Mazen himself?
That's Abu Mazen himself, yes.
Okay.
Abu Mazen right now is the weakest he has ever been. Mm-hmm. His support is much weaker than it used to be. If there would be any kind of elections these days, he would be destroyed by any opponent whatsoever. I think people are willing to vote for somebody they've never heard of, never basically done anything for Palestinians, rather than voting again for Abu Mazen, which is, by the way, he's been a president without being elected since 2009.
2009. I was going to say that there's been no election for
Time it was in 2005. He was elected in 2005. His term ended in 2009. Mm-hmm. And he's been still the president, the dictator of Palestine ever since. And he's called by people like myself and a lot other as a collaborator more than an actual president. I also wanted to add something that I completely forgot. Bear with me, that Shireen was murdered and then she was assaulted after she was dead. During her funeral at the French hospital in Jerusalem, a lot of Palestinians gathered to commemorate her basically and to pay her the respect by taking her casket and an Arab thing. I don't know if it's everywhere around the world, but like to carry her on their shoulders. That's very important. And the funeral was brutally attacked by the Israeli forces. And the goal was to basically, that was completely like from the videos that I've seen, it's not anybody's, a lot of people wrote about it. A lot of people agree with me. It was an attempt to make the body fall from the casket and to lose its dignity. That was the only goal of the Israeli attack, the Israeli forces. It was unprovoked, it was unnecessary, but it was to show that like even your idols, your Palestinian idols are nothing to us. And we have zero respect to your grief and to your mourning. It didn't stop there the whole time until she got to the church. It was attacked the whole way from point A to point B. And that's something I felt that it's important to add as well.
Yeah, and by that same token, what has been the response of the Christian community or Christians in the United States? I haven't seen very much about that. She was a Christian.
She was a Christian, but the Palestinian nature of people exceeds everything else.
Yeah.
In the eyes of, I don't want to say the entire world, but I want to say the people dominating the mainstream media. You can be a saint, but if you're a Palestinian, then you are a Palestinian first. And that was clear in every news segment that I read, at least. Christians around the world, I don't believe that this fact, like, let's start with Christian Palestinians. I'm very proud of every Palestinian right now because they didn't see her as a Christian or as a Muslim or as a atheist or as whatever she wants to believe in. The overwhelming majority saw her as a journalist, a human being, and a wonderful, warm human being. And it's a shame that we lost her this way.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Just to let people know, you can raise your hand if you go down to reactions at the bottom of your screen. There's a raise your hand.
Okay, Uri, Jeff. Uri's hand is raised.
Yeah.
I think Uri has a question or a comment.
You want to call? I'll call Jeff. Yeah, I think you were next.
Okay, thank you, Saya. Let me focus in on the bullet. How useful would the bullet be forensically? For example, can the bullet distinguish an Israeli gun from a presumed Palestinian gun? What else can they do with the bullet?
So what I understand and what I read and from playing a lot of video games when I was younger, not every bullet can be identified from which source, but a sniper rifle bullet is something that you don't really find with the people who are, let's call them resistance warrior or like in Jenin specifically. They would use either M16s or AK-47s or the Carlo, the very improvised Palestinian short gun. So those have low calibers. They're different. Their wounds would be different. Their impact would be different. And the damage that they do is basically less damage that they cause. But a sniper rifle is like, it's a long range weapon that the goal is like to hit to kill in the first impact, on impact. And usually the bullets are armor piercing, and they, if there's no armor, they would explode on impact or after penetration. So the fragments they found, what I saw from the Palestinian surgeon general, I believe his title, the person who was in charge of the autopsy, clearly indicated that it was an exploded bullet, and they managed to take fragments of it. It wasn't a bullet that, like a regular bullet from a gun, from a handheld gun, or a short rifle doesn't explode in the body. Usually it might stay in the body, or it can give, an exit wound, but it doesn't really like cause as much damage as those high caliber rifles. So it was clearly a sniper rifle, and it's exclusively used by Israeli army.
Okay, Billy Norris, you have.
Yeah. Hi, everyone. Hi, Jeff and Duke. It's been a long time since I attended an LA Jews for Peace event. I'm in Santa Maria, California, and Thayer, I wanted to express my gratitude for your presentation and I'm so glad you're recording this. And I have to leave in a couple of minutes. I've been, what's the word? Well, you've shared in the life of Shireen. I have her on the other screen on her Facebook page and stuff like that. I will, I'll do all I can to not just get the word out, but more deeply, my resolve to support the cause of the Palestinians, people hold a lot of negative information about Palestinians or about people, about this, about that, and so on. And it's ignorance, and ignorance is much easier than knowledge. I'm in a 12-step program from 37 years, and I'm writing the 12 steps for all kind of thing, which is a path to let go of resentment and fear and anger and stuff, and to approach life with love and compassion and understanding and willingness to grow. And so anyhow, I'm on board with you all. And Thayer, thank you so much. And I'm going to put my email address in the chat. Anyone's welcome to communicate with me. And thank you, Jeff, for the invitation. And I'll be talking or emailing about dues also. I will become a dues paying member. But I do need to say goodbye. And thank you, Thayer.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that.
I have a question. What do you think is the motive behind the assassination? You say it's up to 20. I mean, it isn't as if the press coverage will stop. I mean, Al Jazeera isn't going to shut down its office or anything. And Israel even blew up a whole press building in the last big attack on Gaza, and the press is still doing it. So I'm just curious, what do they gain by this? I mean, it's such bad publicity for Israel.
I think other than the fact that they do these kind of acts with complete impunity every time, they don't even get a slap on the wrist, whereby the atrocities and the ethnic cleansing and the displacement, forced displacement, and the killing of journalists, I believe that it was a morale hit, which is a strategy of war. It's not something new, to hit the morale of Palestinians and to show basically that none of us is protected and none of us is safe. And it can happen in front of a camera. The whole world is watching. I mean, I remember a name, and you can research that, during the second intifada, named Muhammad al-Durra. Muhammad al-Durra was hiding behind his father, that his father was hiding behind a barrel, and multiple Israeli soldiers were shooting at them, hailing bullets at them, until they killed the child. And the dad was just sitting there helpless, holding his dead son. And that was filmed, and there was a complete awareness of the people filmed. There is evidence that says that they were spotted being filmed, like the film people, the people behind the cameras were spotted, and they were allowed to film this. So those are tactics. I believe that there was a command from a high up in the command chain to do this act, and it wasn't like a lone soldier who retaliated and did something on his own. So it was orchestrated, it was planned, and it was executed. And all to show who's the boss, who owns the business, and who owns the people and the people's lives.
Okay, thank you. Uri's next, then I guess Doreen, and then Jeff. Jeff Werner.
Hi there, how you doing?
Good, how are you?
I'm doing terrific. So first of all, accept my personal condolences.
You got to move closer to your mic, Uri.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Very well.
Okay, good. So that's an improvement. So a couple of things I want to play the devil's advocate. But on one hand, I think the Israelis, whether they intended to kill it or not, shot themselves in the foot 10 times worse when the pictures of the funeral were all over the world. That was 10 times worse, whether the Israelis killed them on purpose or mistake, or it was whatever the story is, the propaganda, the Israeli propaganda got 10 times, 100 times worse because the whole world saw a Christian, American Christian, actually being humiliated. And this is really the decency of any human being who said that was kind of against it. So I'm not sure, by the way, I read the Israeli press about it continuously. And I think it was a mid-level decision. It was not a high rank because they would have known that it would create a major issue. Nevertheless, I want to challenge you on a couple of things. I want to be the devil's advocate. Because the Israeli propaganda says in the last 40 years, more than 2,000 journalists were killed all over the world in all kinds of conflicts and wars. So they say, what's the big deal? It's another one gone. Yeah, we killed 20 of them Palestinians. So what's the big deal? And they say, look what happened to Jamal Khashoggi. Yeah, they assassinated him. The Saudis, the United States knows it. He was an American green card. And business is business. $20 or $100 billion of worth of armament is worth to the United States a whole lot more than one journalist. Big deal. So this is really a perspective that I got that reviles me because I'm an American citizen. I'm part of the people who pay those taxes to subsidize the Saudis. But on the other hand, anyhow, it's kind of like, now as far as like the conversation about the bullet, it's not specific because even if you claim that there's specific ammunition, which is highly doubtful, but they do that, it's not necessarily unique just to the Israeli army. It's not necessarily unique to anybody. You can get that ammunition. So just a footnote. Thanks.
So it wasn't just the bullet, obviously. The bullet was one piece of evidence. There were multiple eyewitnesses as well. And there was also the bullets in the scene, the other bullets shot that they were collected and the marks that the bullet left on the trees and on the floor, showing like if you randomly shoot from 170 to 190 meters,
yeah,
that's about, I think, 200 yards or maybe between 150 to 200 yards. If you shoot without aiming, it is almost impossible to shoot at the same target that is like about 5 to 6 feet radius, right? From that far away. The bullets would be probably hundreds of feet apart, maybe tens of feet apart. But the way they were like the fragmentation, the impacts that they did, they were like in the same area. And it shows a deliberate, and that's from CNN as well, by the way. You can look at the CNN report and you can see what they found out alongside with the Associated Press as well. So both of them, like I agree with you. I wouldn't rely on just the bullet. The bullet is one piece of the puzzle, but you have multiple evidences and eyewitnesses that says that it was deliberate. And honestly, even you don't need to be that much of an expert on those kind of things. You can just watch the video yourself and you would see that it was deliberate. It wasn't accidental. Maybe they didn't want to kill her. Maybe they wanted just to shoot at her, but it was deliberate that she was on their scope. She was like the target or the journalist in general who were with her.
Okay, Doreen.
Thank you, Thayer, for this very detailed explanation. Have you followed if any reaction there is from the left in Israel to this? I saw it, I did read about it on 972, but I didn't follow anything after that.
It's very interesting, actually. Individuals, yes. I know and I follow individual Israeli leftists people who would write on their social media. And they condemn it, of course. They believe that this is a very sad moment for Palestinians and for the truth. But the thing is, it is a minority and a very small one. If you follow any Israeli media, mainstream or not, it would be either complete dismissal to the fact that it happened, like, we don't care, so what, she died, or even worse than that, dehumanizing her and making her basically the enemy of Israel because she was reporting, they call her Okeret Israel, like me, somebody who's undermining, like working to undermine Israel and the Israel status in the world. So it was like a lot of negative comments, a lot of negative things. And sometimes in major news media, like the Channel 12, Channel 13, and Channel 11, the Israeli main TV channels, they wouldn't mention her name. They would say a journalist, a Palestinian journalist, for the first few hours. They wouldn't even mention her in her name. And then they would justify it that, like, she was in a confrontation zone, and basically that she deserved what she got. That's the sentiment that at least I saw from watching the news channels.
Thank you.
We had a couple questions in the chat. One is from Sona. Sona, you want me to read it, or did you want to ask it?
You can read it, Dick.
Okay. Sona said, is there anything we can do in terms of demanding justice other than sharing on social media? Any international organizations we can write to? Political actions.
I saw yesterday and today that there's a bipartisan group of senators who are formally demanding a detached investigation to the murder of Shireen Abu Akleh. Even Mitt Romney was signed on that, which is shocking to me a little bit. But I believe if you could, let's say, contact your representative and demand justice for Shireen Abu Akleh, I think that's like the least that we can all do at some point. Keeping her, posting on social media about her, and remembering her message. I think those are the main things that we can do.
Thank you. Okay, Daryl. You said you had, and then we'll get to Jeff, who's at his electronic hand.
Thank you. Good to see so many good friends here. Thank you. And thank you for today, because this has so affected so many. I have a flyer outside my door here about this death. Just a few things. I was amazed the next morning in the LA Times, they actually really gave a pretty good statement. Of course, it came with the Associated Press. And although the first paragraph is in the passive mood, she was killed. But most of it was telling about what's happening, what she covered, and particularly talking about how she covered the forced home evictions, the killing of Palestinian youths, the hundreds of Palestinians held without charge in Israeli prisons, and the continuous expansion of Jewish settlements. This came from the Associated Press and was on the third page of the LA Times. I was amazed. And I just think we ought to maybe, I have a suggestion about that, but they are, I think, are to be commended in contrast to so many other news reports. Secondly, somebody had reported, if the IDF did this kind of assault on the funeral procession, and they knew this was going out to all the world, what do you think they're doing when nobody's watching? day by day on the occupied territories? What do you think they're doing day by day? Third thing I'd like to say, some of the church groups have spoken out, not so much from the high officials, but groups like Friends of Seville of Southern California and nationally. I know our own Presbyterian General Assembly leader, as a Black man, has spoken out about this kind of thing and about this issue of her death. So there are voices, but of course they never get in the news. And the fourth thing I'd like to suggest, is, since the New York Times, LA Times did have something I thought very noteworthy to say, is there any room for some of us to actually meet with their editorial board to thank them and also to try to establish a connection? Years ago, some of us met with the editorial board when the LA Times was downtown, and at least we got a voice. And I'm wondering whether LA Jews for Peace and maybe a few others of us would like to have a meeting with the editorial board, I think, which is settled down there, down in Torrance or something. But just a thought, let's keep this open with the LA Times. Maybe they'll continue to say some good things that are accurate from compared to what we usually get in media. Thank you.
Thank you, Daryl. I 100% agree with you that this kind of effort wouldn't be in vain. People would probably consider it, even if it doesn't happen immediately. But I feel that there's a media shift towards the believability of the Palestinian struggle and suffering.
Yeah.
I truly believe that. Maybe not in mainstream media, but the sources that I read on a day-to-day basis are maybe not as fancy as the New York Times or LA Times or whatever BBC magazines and all of those things, but it's actually people posting videos on a daily basis. For example, if you follow Ion Palestine on social media, or I don't have like things on top of my mind, but I can send a huge list of people and organizations to follow on social media, because they use it because it's an alternative platform. People want fast information, and information sometimes that you are watching it live while it happens. So those things are affecting, because as I said earlier, I believe that the time of monopoly over information is dying. And yeah, going forward with reaching out to local magazines and try to convince them that what they're doing, if they do something right, what they're doing is valuable, I believe that that has an impact. Yes, I agree with you.
Just as an aside, I think it would be very helpful for people on this call and the other people who are going to watch it when it's the tape, to have that list, because people mostly know electronic media that is easy to find, like corporate television, or they know websites like Electronic Intifada. But there's a lot of other sources of information that people don't know about. So if you could send that to us, we'll forward it to our various lists. That would be really helpful.
Yeah.
Okay. I saw that David Mandel had a comment in the chat. David, are you there? I don't see you.
I am here.
Okay, great.
Multitasking, so I'm not doing a video. You can read it, or I'll just say it. Thanks very much for joining us. I wanted to ask whether I've heard other number of journalists killed by the Israeli forces from the Palestinian Journalist Syndicate as high as 50. And I'm wondering if you can, is there just a different definition of what constitutes a journalist or something? You know, I think that the facts are very important. And some people hear discrepancies like that, they wonder what's the real truth? Can I explain that?
Yes, I heard the same number, honestly, from, I don't remember which news channel, but it was a news channel in Arabic, probably Al Arabi, which is a Qatari-based journal, like a news TV channel, or Al Jazeera. But I couldn't find the actual numbers, because when I look at numbers, I try to see if they have the list of names as well and the certain circumstances of death. What I found is 20 names, 21 names to be exact. to be exact. And since the year 2002. There was one year in particular, 2014, where 8 journalists were killed. But the number 50 also, I read about that. I saw that, sorry, in TV, but I couldn't really confirm or deny the number.
Okay. Jeff Warner, then Tony LaTwinko.
Well, first of all, Daryl, you know, you're right. We got to encourage the LA Times, but the LA Times isn't really that alone. The New York Times covered it, and the Washington Post, and most of the major media actually covered that incident. But this incident happened in Jenin, and Jenin is part of Area A. That's the part of the West Bank that's solely under Palestinian control, Palestinian rules and Palestinian security controls. So what the heck was the IDF, the Israeli army, doing there?
Those are, they're called routine operations by Israel. They would give an explanation such as, we were trying to capture terrorists. And they declare it as a war zone. And then it means that like everything goes. They use any mean necessary. There are videos that show clearly shooting towards civilians in case every person in Palestine becomes the enemy. I mean, it doesn't really become the enemy because what I saw and what I believe and what I witnessed is that like we as Palestinians, it doesn't matter if we're Palestinian 48ers with Israeli IDs or Palestinians in the West Bank or Palestinians in Gaza, the fact that we are Arabs, as Israel would like to call us because they don't want the name Palestinian to be legal, basically, we're all enemies. I was a potential enemy one time in a peaceful march in 2008. I was assaulted and beaten by at least 5 police officers in black uniforms without any kind of form of identification. And then I was dragged and put in prison for almost, I think, 10 days. And I was about to be prosecuted. My lawyers came the last night I was in prison and told me that I'm gonna be in jail for at least 13 years because they couldn't find any kind of form of alibi or not an alibi, like an eyewitness that showed that I didn't do anything until the day of the prosecution, where they actually find the video that showed the whole incident. And then they dropped the charges. Bottom line is, as long as you don't have the evidence that clearly showed that you are innocent, you are always going to be guilty. And people in Palestinians everywhere in that between the river to the sea in all of Israel, Palestine, are going to be treated like enemies. So the fact that Israel goes to Jenin, that Israel declares war on Gaza every other year. And they carpet bomb Gaza without any kind of remorse. And Gaza is 70%, I believe, of people in Gaza are under the age of 25. So like, think about how many kids under the age of 15 are in Gaza. And so, yeah, it doesn't make any difference. Whether it's in Jenin or elsewhere. Israel feels that the entire land is Israel and they act like it.
Jeff, let's see, Rick, you had a question.
Yeah, thanks, Dick. Thank you there for speaking about this so articulately. first thing I want to say is that this business of how audacious and outrageous the Israelis are acting is kind of a double-edged sword. If there is going to be a groundswell of reaction in the press, it's going to come from below, from the low ranks of the press, not the owners. And they're going to see how dedicated Israel is against a free press. And what they did to Shireen follows on the heels of the aerial bombardment and destruction of the AP Al Jazeera building in Gaza. So anybody who's paying attention, which granted is a limited number of people, nonetheless, if you're in the press, you might get wind. You could hardly miss that bombardment. That spectacular picture of that building coming down, I think, was an advertisement of Israel against itself because it seeks legitimacy and it's proving itself illegitimate more and more as, you know, the hubris of them begets mistakes and stupidities like this. They don't, what do they gain by that, you know? But they lose a lot in the eyes of, you know, rational people in the press. And so that's Richard Falk's line, really, not my perspective. I'm just borrowing his, that after the middle of the 20th century, it's legitimacy. It's, you know, the Vietnamese were outgunned, but they won. Other people have won. I'm not saying it's inevitable that Palestine's going to win. I'm just saying that it's otherwise, how do we explain to ourselves, you know, how disgustingly brutal in broad daylight they could be to attack Al Jazeera? And you tell me, Thayer, isn't Al Jazeera a powerful voice in the Arabic world of, 120, 140 million people? I don't know how many. I just don't understand, other than just raw hatred, why they would do this. But I guess maybe you explain it. You said, you know, she's a powerful voice.
So Al Jazeera is the biggest news channel in the Arab world. People might not be, might not agree with Al Jazeera on a lot of topics, but when it comes to Palestine, the majority of people I know would believe Al Jazeera blindly, that they show their support by showing the truth, because Palestinians don't really need hasbara. They don't need propaganda. If you really are interested to know about Palestine, it's all out there, all for, like, you just go and be in Palestine. You don't even need to rely on things you see in the news or watch on TV. If you go to Palestine and just look at checkpoints and the huge walls around cities and the lifestyle of Palestine, you would understand that this is something that isn't, that this is wrong, that this is not the way people should live. And Al Jazeera has been meticulously doing that throughout the years since Al Jazeera was established. And I truly, truly believe that Al Jazeera helped the Palestinian cause way more than any other entity. And the fact that Israel attacked their building, the communications building, the office building with the Al Jazeera, it was completely to send a message. That wasn't just, you know, an act of, oh, we accidentally shelled a building. It was a targeted missile that was intended to collapse the whole building. So that is a deliberate thing. And I believe that because of how many years have passed with the world basically turning a blind eye over Palestinians, Israel felt that they are sort of immune to criticism and to world condemnation. I hope that gave you a little bit of my perspective about it.
Could I just make one further comment, Dick?
Sure.
Thank you, Thayer. Yeah, I really like what you said. There's a, I think, an important article that was in New Yorker magazine about a month ago on the NSO group. So it's further down the same path that the Israeli government worked hand in glove with this group that put out the software Pegasus, which is a predatory software that allegedly was responsible or involved with the killing of Khashoggi and a lot of other crimes. And finally got them in enough trouble so that they've been taken to court on major, huge dollar amount and is putting them out of business because of, again, the illegitimate way they were operating with Israeli government cooperation and approval. And I just, Ronan Farrell, by the way, is the guy that wrote that article, and I commend it to everybody because it's kind of an influential article because he's a very popular and, you know, a very high profile reporter. And the way he writes it shows the intimate connection between the Israeli government and really the, you know, the destruction of any kind of personal freedom. So I just wanted to tell people about that article. I don't have the name of it, but check it out if you can get a hold of it.
That was in the New Yorker?
Yeah, in the New Yorker. I've got it in the next room if somebody wants. I'll put it in the chat, the issue. It's about 2-3 weeks ago, maybe a month ago.
Okay.
Okay, Tony, you've had your hand up for a while.
Yeah, a couple of comments. First of all, following Ralph Nader's suggestions, when you write to your congressman, make sure that you specify that you don't want a form letter in response. I think the State Department should be addressed as well. They've been pretty cowardly with the response to the whole thing. Latouf has got a wonderful cartoon of Biden shaking a bloodied Israeli soldier's hand while standing on Shireen Abu Akleh's corpse in a recent cartoon. And they talk about how they're not going to really investigate. The second thing is, I beg to differ somewhat with you on the Los Angeles Times, that they used an Associated Press article rather than their own shows how they're kind of passing the buck. And if you look at the LA Times, the day when they were reporting on the Jerusalem marches, and you see this poor protester lying on his side with one Israeli policeman or soldier or special forces guy kneeling on his shoulder and another one holding a baton getting ready to hit him in the testicles. And the LA Times describes it as he was detained. We can go to the LA Times, but I think we should point out their cowardice. In general, I think the US press has been extremely cowardly with regard to the safety of journalists. And we've got an issue coming up with what is going to happen with our Wikipedia, our Wikimedia, WikiLeaks fellow who's hanging in suspense in the British court system right now. So this might be part of a thing to meet with the LA Times and accuse them of, well, not accuse them, but talk about their lack of courage in covering issues in the Middle East and freedom for journalists in general.
Yeah.
I'll get off my rant.
Thank you, Tony. Actually, I don't really consume the LA Times at all. So I thought that there was like a, because I read the headlines and I understand immediately that this is biased towards the Israeli government and not really trying to convey any kind of truth. That's why I try to prevent from reading from them. But I thought maybe in this specific article that was discussed that they actually had a change of heart and they do wanted to, mention the actual incident.
I was going to offer another comment. At least for me, I've always thought of Hasbara, which you talked about, Thayer. Sometimes we translate that as propaganda or spin in English. is something that happened in Israel, but I now realize that the corporate media, you know, CNN, Fox News, MSNBC, the main newspapers, they have Hasbara as well. And I think it was the Ukraine where it really became obvious to me. And I'm curious about the contradiction, because the Hasbara in the United States is, well, we're here to defend democracy. We have to give, you know, $50 or $60 billion to the Ukraine to defend democracy. But, I mean, the treatment of reporters blowing up a press building, maintaining an apartheid state, support for Morsi, well, I guess now Sisi in Egypt, Saudi Arabia. I mean, this is like the antithesis of democracy. So I wonder what your thoughts are about this gross contradiction in U.S. foreign policy.
I would start by actually stretching the term even further. I don't believe anymore that Israel is an apartheid state. I do believe that Israel is a white supremacist settler colony, that it's an ethno state that divides between different ethnicities, different backgrounds. The world showed its natural face by condemning what is happening, like justifiably condemning the war against Ukraine, but from all the wrong reasons. It was discussed in multiple news how they're white people with blue eyes just like us, and they don't deserve that, the Ukrainians. Not that like there is, you know, a conflict happening and we need to actually be neutral in the way we cover it and to show the progression and the outcome of the horrible war that is happening. Comparing to Palestinians, they're brown. Brown people, you know, they matter less. And the world doesn't see us as equal to like Ukrainians, although our struggle has been for 74 years, millions resulting in millions of refugees. I don't know how many thousands of casualties and ongoing displacement and ethnic cleansing and, you know, the annexation of Palestinian lands. And when I say annexation of Palestinian land, I'm not just talking about West Bank and Gaza. I'm also talking at the Negev, for example, which is a Naqab in Arabi, and all the unrecognized Bedouin villages who like more than 50,000 people are living in an unrecognized and uncared for environment. So when you talk to me about the comparison, there is no comparison. There are two group of people, which one of them is considered people and the other one is dehumanized. That's been clear since the beginning of the war about 100 and so days ago in between Russia and Ukraine. And I try not to talk about it because the world has showed that they don't want to actually like talk about the truth. They just want to be anti-Russian. I refuse to be anti-Russian, obviously, or anti-Ukrainian. I support the people of both countries, but I do not support acts of violence and military invasions. Basically that's it.
I'm looking, there's a few people who haven't talked yet. Do we have any other hands? Well, I have one more question then, if you could talk a little bit more about the social media sources that you've used, because yes. I think a lot of people here don't know a lot about some of these sources, so it would be helpful.
So the most credible ones I would assume would be that I follow, that they have like hands on the most time sensitive issues that happen right away. They cover, for example, what happens in Sheikh Jarrah, which is a neighborhood in East Jerusalem that is under they're being like basically forcefully evicted from their houses. Mm-hmm. There is a court rule, a court battle between the people of the owners of the houses in Sheikh Jarrah and the government that tries to basically displace them and give their homes to settlers. So what I mentioned before, Eye on Palestine, the Middle East Eye, for example, Pali Roots, which is an organization that tries to shed light. Individuals like Muhammad al-Kurd and Mona al-Kurd are basically icons in, they're both from Sheikh Jarrah. They're very, the brother Muhammad al-Kurd is, his English is exceptional. He is like very eloquent and he knows how to debate the issue of Palestine. His sister is, I don't know if her English is any, is as good, but her Arabic is excellent. And she's like a field journalist without being part of any kind of organization. Those are the people on top of my head that I can think of, but I can send you an email after.
That'll be great.
Speaking, yeah. With everybody that I personally follow that I believe that they have credible sources. They are credible sources.
Do that.
Okay, I think Jeff, you have your hand up. Jeff Werner.
Yes, I do. Well, first of all, Thayer, if you can, I will send out the link to the recording in about an hour or an hour and a half after we're done. So I'll wait till 11 o'clock to 11 o'clock tonight. If you can get me a list by then, I will include it in that email that I send out.
Yeah, sure. I think it's doable. Of course.
Congress has barely been mentioned in today's discussion, but there's been a lot more mention of the press, and Tony, in particular, is very upset. Called the LA Times chicken or weak or something like that. Well, the LA Times is a large organization, and as such, it supports the status quo. And the status quo is set by the discussion in Congress. And the LA Times does more now than it did 10 years ago. And that's because the Democrats in Congress are standing up more today for Palestine and justice than they did 10 years ago.
For some this Democrats.
Excuse
me? Some Democrats.
I didn't say every Democrat, Tony. I said some Democrats. There have been at least two congressional letters about this incident, and there have been at least three about the expulsions at Masafa Yatta. And I want to remind people that on July 18th, we're having this whole talk about those expulsions. So what you're going to find is that the large institutions, which include the LA Times and the Washington Post and the Philadelphia Inquirer and the New York Times, are going to follow the establishment. And the establishment follows what's dictated in Congress. So our goal shouldn't be trying to get the LA Times to be less weak. Our goal should be to get more Democrats and other people in Congress to stand up for justice. And already there's a strong movement among the Democrats. It's a lot stronger now than it was a decade ago. And even then it was stronger than 5 years before that. I keep a list of congressional letters that have to do with the topic of Israel-Palestine. And they're not everyone, they're not one every month, but over the course of a year, there's a dozen or so. So our Sonia asked, what can we do? Well, Dick, I guess, answered, or someone answered, is talk to Congress. And that's exactly right. And that's where the focus of all our efforts should be. We'll do, even as hard as it is to talk to Congress, as difficult as it is because they don't want to listen, my congressman being one of the worst, will make more progress, I think, talking to Congress and trying to get the LA Times to be less chicken. Okay, thank you.
Okay, do are any more? Oh, Yossi Chen.
Yeah, I was just listening to all the discussion, and in the beginning, I feel like I don't have anything to add because I was following this news every day. First, I want to tell you, thank you, Tyler, that you came out and put this special, unique perspective. As a matter of fact, I went to Israel day after the assassination of Shirin, and I went to a meeting that something to do with Abraham Initiative, maybe you know. And I had the day I left, I read the Washington Post report about the assassination. And I thought that this was very good report because they approached B'Tselem, the Israeli human rights group. They did right away investigations. They challenged the Israeli official line that this was maybe Palestinians or exchange files between. And B'Tselem said that the exchange file was 350 meters from where Shirin was. And there were so many houses and buildings in between, there is no way. And when she arrived where she was killed, the exchange of fire already stopped. And then came the single bullet of a sniper right to her throat. And this bullet was not an attempt maybe to wounded her or not, because if you want to wound it by sniper, you shoot in the foot. Mm-hmm. You shoot in the knee, what they did in Gaza, the snipers. Sometimes they shot people in their knees. But when you shoot a bullet to your throat, there was a shoot to kill. Mm-hmm. But Washington Post, they said they did the own investigation using B'Tselem, and they confirmed that what B'Tselem said and the witnesses said was absolutely 100% right. So they did, and I brought with me to Israel to show my friends what the US major media like Washington Post wrote about. And they were very surprised because watching a little bit the Israeli TV and how they approached this, I was just disgusted because some commentators said, what's it doing a big thing about this? For 3 days and making a festival around here, and what is this nonsense? And why is they even bringing this? You know, who she is anyway? This is how they put it. But the reaction for some progressive writers in Haaretz paper was very sharp, mm-hmm. of accusing the TV of being subhuman, or because they treat her as a subhuman, or being completely 100% cynical. Now, you ask yourself, so why they beating, why the police and when they're being the funeral? Why are they doing what they're doing? How they get away of this? And my 2 cents about this, the Israeli government and the Western world, or let's say the Israeli government is part of the Western world. You remember the expression, this guy is a son of a bitch, but he's our son of a bitch.
Lyndon Johnson.
They're talking about some dictator in Latin America.
Formosa.
So the Israeli government is allies of NATO, is allies, close allies of United States, is a good friend of Russia and China also. So it's much more than just the Western world. Very close friends of Vladimir Putin. And so they feel, at least from their point of view, that whatever they do, the aides from the United States and the US Congress will continue, the money will flow. So if shit happened, not a big deal. they're going to continue to get. So this is the reality. But a week ago or more, as I came back, well, I think even where I saw it on an Israeli paper, Arabs, sometimes they give information about what's people thinking in the US about Israel that you don't see in the US media. So they brought a Pew, you know, P-E-W research. There was a poll was done in March, they said, and they show for the first time young people under 30 in the United States have more sympathy to the Palestinians than to Israel. And they say this is the first time. And they make the Israeli government people in Israel to start worry about this. And this is what it's showing what's happening in the US. And I think around the world that the, at least young generations, because social media and information we they get, the governments are still with an old policy, but something happening under, you know, among at least young generations around the world and in the United States. I don't know what's happening in Germany or England or France, but Pew, he was talking about the young people in the US, huh? For the first time, there are more sympathy to Palestinians. So it shows that whatever happening, it's building up under. And I agree 100% with Jeff about the shift that's happening inside the Democratic Party with a new member of Congress especially, that there is some changes, that there is more openness and more willingness to criticize the Israeli government policy. And people like us have to take advantage of this and make the call these people and show them that you're doing a good job and try to talk to. I know that my congressman, it's a lost cause, is Brad Sherman, but at least others. I even said that we should call Alex Padilla because I believe that Dianne Feinstein got a problem of the writing that she became senile, unfortunately, you know. So you're not sure you can talk to her, but at least to Alex Padilla, he's considered to be liberal Democrat. It's worth to put the pressure and using all this stuff that we saw and saying, this is basic democratic rights. This is abuse. And how you as a senator of a country who pretend defend democracy, how you handle this? How do you deal with this? It's worth to take a shot, because we don't have too much option in the United States. Not really. It's very easy to talk to each other between us, so we don't have to do so much conviction, you know. But anyway, this is my two cents about this. Oh, one thing I remember, there is an Arab parliament member, his name Ahmed Tibi. He called one parliament member from Yesh Atid, from Yair Lapid party, you are disgusting, or ne'lechet, because she appeared in a panel about Shirin Abu Akla, and she said, who she is anyway? Why I have to waste my time even talking about her? What she did for the world? What? Why? Who she is, you know? So he got so angry, and in a parliament, he called her ne'lechet.
Chel'at Adam.
Chel'at Adam, yeah, Chel'at Adam. Which I don't know how to exactly translate it to.
Scum, a human scum.
Human scum, okay. And she started crying. And there was one journalist in Haaretz saying, you should cry, you cry even more, because he was absolutely right. You know, how dare, you know, the whole world shows what happened and you saying who she is? What's wrong with you? And he was right, you are a scum, you know. And this was a Jewish journalist who have a regular column in Haaretz. He told her, you know, he was absolutely right the way he described you. And you should look in the mirror and ask yourself who you are anyway. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Uri, I think you'll be the last one, unless there's some other person who hasn't spoken yet.
Oh, I always, can you hear me?
We always have a lot of trouble hearing you. You got to really move up close to your microphone.
Can you hear me now?
A little better.
Okay. So I just want to give you my 2 cents worth of the whole thing. And I'm the eternal pessimist. So I'm in the background of the whole thing. There's 50 Republican senators who are not going to budge on the issue of guns. And this is killing American citizens by the hundreds. Why would the US Congress even care about what's happening in far-flung countries? So this is kind of like I'm saying, yeah, the whole conversation is nice. We talk about morality and conscience and what's right and all that. Ultimately, the ultimate thing that decides in the United States is this one. In God we trust, it has to be in green. So that's why we're willing to deal with Saudi Arabia, even though they killed a US journalist. That's why we're willing to deal with all the other people that scum in the world. So just to add a perspective to that thing, as a side, we talked about Pegasus. The United States of America, when there was a change of government in Mexico, the guy who did the whole thing escaped to Israel. He's not a Jew. Israel was declining to basically give him back to Mexico despite all the agreements and everything. Because basically he's the one who authorized the Pegasus in Mexico that helped 6, 7, 8 years ago follow all the journalists that helped kill them. So Israel is pretty much with blood on its hand alongside the United States. And ultimately, the military industrial complex that Eisenhower talked about 60 years ago still runs this country. 17 people were killed by guns this weekend in the United States, American citizens, not Palestinians, not Israelis, not blacks, not red, nothing. And it's been going on for, I don't know, they said this is the 246th time this year there was a major shootout in the United States. So when I put the whole thing in perspective, I said, why would they even bother if they don't do things for American citizens? Why would they even bother to do anything in the Middle East? Especially, and this is my contention always, as long as the United States gives Israel the umbrella in the Security Council of the United Nations, nothing is going to change in the Middle East. As much as I hate the whole thing, that's the way I see it. And I'm sorry to pee on the parade.
Why don't you answer, Thayer, and then we'll call it a night.
What you said was pretty much accurate about the money, that unless it actually impacts the US's economy directly and deliberately, I believe more than that. I believe that if the American people understand, not just know and mention, understand the amount of money being spent on the, you know, like the support for Israel and what that money could do if it stays in America for the American people, I truly believe that there might be a chance of change. But the fact that people here are not aware makes what you just said probably right. It's not going to happen. It's not going to change anytime soon. But it doesn't mean that we shouldn't keep persisting and spreading as much as we can to the world what is happening there.
Okay, just one final word. I think Daryl had to leave, but I think maybe Jeff, Rick Chertoff, and Daryl ought to brainstorm a little bit about a visit to the LA Times. I know Nicholas Goldberg a bit. He's now a columnist. He used to be the editorial page editor, so I can ask him if you guys think there's a critical mass to have a visit to the LA Times editorial staff to ask him how to proceed.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Thayer.
And Nick Goldberg has spoken in his column about he was the LA Times correspondent in Jerusalem for a while.
Yeah.
And he's discussed various things and is certainly sympathetic with our point of view.
And he used to go to some of the sessions at the Levantine Center when it existed. That's where she showed up there a few times. Okay, Jeff, so you'll be sending out the video of tonight's Zoom meeting, and Thayer, you're gonna go put together a little list that of some of the social media. Okay, thank you,
everybody. I will hold off sending it till 11 p.m. so that Thayer can get a list to me.
Jeff, one more thing, the thing on the Iranian nuclear deal, that's scheduled for the 20th, right? Because when you had your flyer up at the beginning, you said June 6th, which is today.
Yes, my mistake. It's changed. Yes, the Iran nuclear deal is discussion will be on the 20th, in 2 weeks from tonight.
At what time?
7 p.m.
7. Okay.
Okay. Good night.
Thank
everybody.
You all.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Thayer.
Thank you, Tony.